While not speaking with the kind of historical insight of Greenspan, Schwartzman illustrated another major consequence of the epical awakening of our age that was comparable to the end of World War II for Mills, or the end of the Civil War for the robber barons, or the decision to disconnect from the world for the Mings. In a global economy in which multinational corporations are no longer bound to any single country, they have gained a new kind of power over national governments, which by their nature are confined by borders. Companies have created a new kind of marketplace in which governments compete with one another for investment, essentially undercutting in a fundamental way some of the most familiar, potent, and until recently enduring foundations of sovereignty. New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman related a pertinent conversation he had had with Intel CEO Craig Barrett. There was a shocking quote. He said, "Intel can thrive today and never hire another American. It is not our desire, it is not our intention, but we can do that." So what it means is that global companies are now hovering over countries. They get disconnected from their moorings. Intel hovers over Southern California, over the U.S., over wherever it may operate in the world. It is not really headquartered. Take the world's 10 biggest corporations: Walmart, ExxonMobil, Shell, BP, General Motors, Chevron, Daimler Chrysler, Toyota, Ford, ConocoPhillips. Besides the fact that four are offsprings of the Seven Sisters spun off from Standard Oil over 100 years ago, in 2006, roughly six out of every $10 of revenue came from operations outside their country of origin, and roughly the same portion, 59% of their employees, were employed outside that country. This internationalization carries over to their boards as well, with an average of one out of five board members coming from outside the country of origin. In fact, for the S&P 500, the biggest publicly listed companies on U.S. stock exchanges, 2007 was a watershed year. For the first time, the 500 companies earned more than half of their revenues internationally rather than from their home market. That's up from 35% overseas revenues just 5 years earlier in 2002. The trend has become so pronounced that investment banks are offering U.S. investors seeking a safe way to invest internationally baskets of U.S. companies that earn most of their revenues abroad. Goldman Sachs introduced one in 2007 that includes 34 major U.S. companies that derive almost two-thirds of their sales internationally. In stock appreciation terms, this group during the first half of 2007 outperformed the market as a whole by more than 2-to-1. In terms of company size, we have clearly come a long way from Mills's day, when the 30 or so companies with revenues in excess of $1 billion a year were the obvious titans of industry. In 2007, the smallest company on the Fortune Global 500, a Canadian aerospace firm called Bombardier, had revenues of $14.9 billion and assets of over $18 billion. The Forbes Global 2000 companies hail from 57 countries, and the smallest has revenues of $40 million. The total assets of these companies are estimated to exceed $100 trillion. In fact, my own company has estimated that there are well over 1,000 companies that we call emerging multinationals that have sales in excess of $1 billion and are located in the world's emerging markets. Our cutoff for superclass membership at being one of the world's 2,000 largest companies means that literally thousands of billion-dollar-plus companies don't make the list. Another way to put how little $1 billion in annual income means today is that among the world's billionaire individuals, the top 62, twice Mills's number of billion-dollar U.S. companies in the late 1950s, would earn over $1 billion a year in income if they made only 10% returns on their assets. Most earn much more. Is this all inflation? No. inflation would take 1956's $1 billion and make it worth roughly $7 billion today. But that $7 billion puts a company at only number 333 on the 2007 Fortune 500. Clearly, the driving factors are economic growth and corporate consolidation. In fact, the numbers associated with today's power elite would likely make Mills's head explode. After all, American GDP in 1956 was $438 billion, not too much more than the current annual revenues of Walmart or ExxonMobil. The federal government spent around $70 billion, which today could be personally funded by one or two of the richest people in the world. Today, we measure power in trillions. The more than $100 trillion in assets owned by the world's 2,000 largest corporations, the $10 trillion controlled by just the 10,000 U.S. mutual funds, which means an average size of $1 billion each, the $2 trillion controlled by the world's 10,000 hedge funds, the $2 trillion in buying power, $400 billion in assets plus available leverage, currently controlled by the world's few hundred private equity firms, the more than $1 trillion in reserves controlled by SAFE, State Administration of Foreign Exchange, China's monetary authority. Each of these trillion-dollar-plus pools of capital, all controlled by fairly small groups of individuals, represents an unprecedented concentration of power. There is a group of a few thousand people among the corporate elite who effectively control perhaps $100 trillion, two-thirds of the world's total assets. The Interlinked Corporate Elite. Mills observed how associations and interlocking directorates increased individuals' influence. But in the global era and the Internet age, such associations are burgeoning and the opportunities for linkages and collaboration have grown dramatically. Giant companies like Procter & Gamble and Boeing carefully coordinate and nurture relationships among the tens of thousands of supplier, distributor, and collaborator companies with which they work. Events like Davos, the Boao Forum for Asia, the Allen & Company event in Sun Valley, the IMF World Bank annual meetings, and thousands of such programs. In 2006, there were over 1 million conferences held in the United States alone, knit elites together. Industry associations do the same, and many such groups have grown to great size and wield great power. For example, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has an annual budget of $150 million and more than 3 million members, and is a powerful voice, particularly for the largest members of the business community. In 2004, they deployed over 200 political operatives to more than 30 states to seek to influence election outcomes on behalf of pro-business candidates. The Washington Post cited the chamber and five other organizations, collectively known as the Gang of Six, as being a source the Bush administration has looked to for vital support of its economic initiatives. The other five were the Business Roundtable, the National Association of Manufacturers, the National Restaurant Association, the National Federation of Independent Businesses, and the National Association of Wholesaler Distributors. Such associations, of which there are thousands today, often have extensive international reach as well, as they include highly influential global corporations. With regard to the concentration of power among individuals, perhaps a more telling demonstration is how boards and management of the biggest companies overlap, linking the superclass in an extended network. For example, if you were to take just the top three corporate executives, in most cases the chairman, CEO, and executive director of the top five biggest companies, as well as the members of their boards, approximately 70 people, you would find that they have active connections fanning out to more than 145 other major companies, either through board memberships, advisory positions, or former positions in senior management. Of these 145, 36 are among the 100 largest in the world, and 52 are in the top 250. 16 of these companies have more than one representative from the top 5 companies on their boards. These 16 are AkzoNobel, ABB, AstraZeneca, British Airways, Deutsche Bank, Ernst & Young, Ford, GE, Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, Lloyds TSB, Pfizer, Royal Bank of Scotland, Sara Lee, Unilever, and Vodafone, all major, major players in their own right. Of these, which one has the most crossover to the top 5 companies? Goldman Sachs, with 4 links. Positions of prominence within the corporate superclass bring with them cross-cutting influence in other areas as well, especially given the enormous wealth that now accumulates in the hands of the corporate elite. I was particularly struck by this fact one day while driving to my office at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Carnegie is on a stretch of Massachusetts Avenue in Washington, D.C., that is known for its think tank community, a row of institutions that are central hubs for generating the policy ideas that ultimately guide the U.S. government. Think tanks and the stories of their endowments illustrate well how business elites can influence the process of agenda setting. The Carnegie Endowment, for example, was one of the long list of philanthropies endowed by Carnegie, but one that gave him special access to the top opinion leaders in the United States and worldwide. Immediately next door is the much larger Brookings Institution, today headed by former Deputy Secretary of State and Time magazine reporter Strobe Talbott, and home to many former senior U.S. government officials. The institution was originally funded with a donation from a St. Louis businessman named Robert Summers Brookings, who made his fortune in the late 19th century in the household goods firm of Couples and Marston, and devoted his later life to philanthropy, becoming the patron of not only what was to become perhaps Washington's most enduring and influential think tank, but also Washington University in St. Louis. In a not entirely surprising sequence of events, in 1916, Brookings endowed something called the Institute for Government Research in the U.S. Capitol, and one year later, he was appointed by President Wilson to the War Industries Board, where he became chair of its price-fixing committee. Two other Brookings-founded entities merged about a decade later to become the institution that now sits next to Carnegie. Across the street that morning, I noticed the new sign in front of the influential Institute for International Economics, a firm that had been founded by former Treasury official Fred Bergston, and that was actually the building in which the term Washington Consensus was coined. The sign read, "The Peter G. Peterson Institute for International Economics." Peterson, Stephen Schwartzman's partner in founding Blackstone and a former Commerce Secretary, was an original patron of Bergston's think tank, and now it bore his name. Also bearing his name are the Peter G. Peterson Chair for the editor of Foreign Affairs magazine at the Council on Foreign Relations, where Peterson is himself the longtime chairman of the board. He also established the Peter G. Peterson Chair in Corporate Ethics at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University. And so it went up and down the street, examples of corporate patrons donating their money to the pursuit of big ideas and, not surprisingly, exerting some influence on what those ideas would be. This is especially the case in the politically motivated think tanks like the right-leaning American Enterprise Institute, funded initially in large part by several family foundations, notably the Howard Pugh Freedom Trust. Its founding chairman, William Baroudy, was forced to resign when his more centrist policies ran afoul of two other major donors, the Smith-Richardson and Olin Foundations. Similarly, on the left, the Center for American Progress was heavily funded by both George Soros, as a result of his concerns about the administration of George W. Bush, and by a group of rich Democrats called the Democracy Alliance. Soros and billionaire Peter Lewis were the dominant voices in the alliance because of the extent of their wealth. Disclaimer: I did some work for the Democracy Alliance during its formative years as an advisor to the founder, Rob Stein, an attorney and former chief of staff at the Commerce Department. Donations can be used to buy global influence in what is now a part of the standard operating procedure of the superclass. Endowments of many kinds, from public buildings to academic titles, add to an individual's prominence and prestige and expand his or her networks of connections. They also help set the agenda and often can be used to motivate think tanks and other not-for-profit organizations to provide independent validation of ideas that are important to the donor or his or her business or political interests. Just a few examples of such endowments, and there are more such examples than there are members of the superclass, however you might define it, include, and even the following are only partial lists for each individual cited: Mukesh Ambani, Ambani Family, Chairman and Managing Director, Reliance Industries Limited; Dhirubhai Ambani International School, Mumbai, India; Dhirubhai Ambani Institute of Information and Communication Technology, Gujarat, India; Dhirubhai Ambani Knowledge City, Navi Mumbai, India; Michael Bloomberg, Mayor of New York City, Founder, Bloomberg LP; Bloomberg Tower, New York City; Bloomberg School of Public Health, Johns Hopkins University; Bloomberg Hall, School of Natural Sciences, Institute for Advanced Study, Princeton University; Emma B. Bloomberg Hall, Princeton University; Bloomberg Chair in Journalism, Columbia University; Charlotte Bloomberg Chair in Art History, Johns Hopkins University; William Henry Bloomberg Professorship, Harvard University; Maurice R. Hank Greenberg, Chairman and CEO, CV Star and Company, former CEO, AIG; Maurice R. Greenberg Center for Geoeconomic Studies, Council on Foreign Relations; Maurice R. Greenberg International Conference Center, Yale University; Weill Greenberg Center, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York City; Maurice Greenberg Center for Judaic Studies, University of Hartford; Maurice R. and Corrine P. Greenberg Building, Asia Society, New York City; Maurice R. and Corrine P. Greenberg Pavilion, New York Presbyterian Hospital; Ratan Tata, Tata Family, Chairman, Tata Group; Tata Institute of Fundamental Research, Mumbai, India; Tata Institute, Bangalore, India; Tata Institute of Social Sciences, Mumbai; Tata Management Training Center, Pune, India; Jamsetji Tata Center for Disaster Management, Mumbai; Tata Memorial Hospital, Mumbai; JRD Tata Eco Technology Center, Chennai, India; Tata Don Academy, Madurai, India; Tata Center, Calcutta, India; Sir Ratan Tata Chair Professor, Indian Institute of Management, Bangalore. Donations to charities are a form of influence not only because they support given causes, they also underscore one's social position. For example, the Robin Hood Foundation annual benefit in New York brings together financial big shots to participate in displays of generosity laced with an element of that conspicuous conscience I mentioned earlier. According to the New York Times, the event raised $71 million, up 32% from a year ago, in what was a display of Gilded Age excess. Larry Robbins, a hedge fund manager, started the evening with a donation of $10 million to the charity, which raises money for teacher training and other efforts to assist poor children. 22 people followed with commitments of $1 million each. Dinner for 10 with the famous chef Mario Batali went for $1.3 million. A trip to the Olympics and a chance to spend time with a television personality brought in almost twice that. Two people paid $400,000 each to sing with the aging heavy metal band Aerosmith. The affair, peppered with stars like Gwyneth Paltrow, Ben Affleck, Martha Stewart, and Michael Douglas, as well as the ubiquitous Steve Schwartzman, was the culmination to date of a program that has raised almost $1 billion for its favorite charities. Networking among the corporate elite can thus take a variety of forms. Working together, doing deals together, sitting on boards together, even attending gala events together. All these things help forge the networks that empower and define the superclass. And these networks begin early. For example, take the Harvard Business School class of 1979. This class alone graduated Meg Whitman, the CEO of eBay, Jeffrey Skilling, the former president of Enron, John Thane, former president of Goldman Sachs and currently head of the New York Stock Exchange, Ron Sargent, the CEO of Staples, George McMillan, the CEO of Palladium Group, Elaine Chao, the Secretary of Labor, who also happens to be married to Republican Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, and Dan Bricklin, who developed the first electronic spreadsheet. And because schools like Oxford, Cambridge, France's École Polytechnique, the Indian Institute of Technology, and the University of Tokyo all perform a similar function, cadres of leaders emerge into the world with important linkages even before other layers of ties begin to form. What global power can do. More important, even than these ties, however, is how those who benefit from them actually exercise their influence in a global way. According to Schwartzman, he and Pete Peterson spent a number of years shifting Blackstone's focus from America to the rest of the world. There are a number of reasons why it took us a while to become the global firm we are today, he told me. First, our home country, the United States, comprises about 30% of global GDP and typically has the friendliest regulatory environment for transactional activities. Also, it offers the ability to transact business with like-minded people who are problem solvers. And so, a lot of the financial innovation that gets done in the world has historically been done in the United States. Being in this primary market discourages you initially from going anywhere else because it's always harder to do business, he went on. The development of video conferencing, which was sufficiently perfected around the year 2000, led to some considerable expansion. This enabled us to open our European operations, which have been extremely successful for us. We then turned to Asia. Describing with enthusiasm what they found in India, he explained, "Starting with private equity, we now have gone into money management. We operate the second biggest mutual fund in India, and we are going to be soon starting real estate activity there. In large part because we believe in doing things sequentially, we want to start with one country and then we will move to others. But what we like about India is they speak English, our native language. It is a huge competitive advantage to be able to communicate. They also have laws, and they have a court system, and even though it is cumbersome, they do have a democracy, so that becomes familiar. Now we are moving into China and Japan, which will become very important markets for us." Schwartzman has seen firsthand the trends that have made global expansion possible for firms like Blackstone, and that have given rise to the leverage that big financial players now have over the governments of the world. A New York Times op-ed I once wrote, called Whistle Stops on Wall Street, commented on an increasingly common phenomenon. Candidates for high political office and current occupants of those offices frequently stop to meet with senior financial officials whenever they are in New York or other financial capitals. The rationale is straightforward. Political leaders recognize that they now report to two constituencies: the voters who elected them, and the financial markets that daily conduct a referendum on their policies. This is the market at work. The system offers a check to political powers. It results in major infusions of needed capital, and it helps produce transparency, fuel job creation, and enforce rules that are proven to lead to economic growth. For example, daily trading in the government bonds market is influenced by traders' views on whether or not government programs are likely to succeed at promoting growth or stability, as well as other factors they feel impact the ability of governments to repay their debts. In the same way, investors reflect their perspectives on political leaders in the prices they set for currencies, stocks, and key commodities that are affected by the decisions of national governments. In just one afternoon in late July 2007, for instance, the Argentine peso fell to its lowest exchange rate level in 4 years. Investors concerned about the country's upcoming elections and the anti-market leanings of likely victor Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner had grown skittish, reducing positions in the peso or betting on it to fall. At the same time, Russian debt markets were pushed down as investors worried that the Putin administration's pressure for more mortgage lending as a stimulus for growth would expose the country's banks to unacceptable risks if the economy soured. While these decisions are not made by a single individual in a room, the community of the largest traders in Russian debt or Argentine pesos is small. They know each other, they know how they will react, and together, just a few shape market sentiment. Sometimes, said one experienced trader, it is a dozen guys who set the price. Sometimes, when people worry about a big investor like a George Soros, it can be about what one man thinks, or what investors think he thinks. In this way, big market players keep political leaders and other policymakers on a short leash. If a minister or president or central bank governor makes a pronouncement that markets find unpalatable one day, the country may find it difficult to borrow the next. This in turn will restrict economic growth, which means fewer jobs or less money for consumers. The rise of the markets as a counterweight to political leaders, coming as more countries are linked to global markets, is primarily a healthy trend. But if the system favors shorter-term returns, large-scale operations, and partners who have influence on the markets, it is also a trend that undercuts long-term growth needs, hurts smaller countries and economies, and exacerbates the inequitable distribution of money and power in many of those countries worldwide. Joe Stiglitz argued in the same vein, only more starkly, during a conversation one evening at his paper-filled office at Columbia University. Capital market liberalization, free and unfettered movement of capital across borders, can, in some sense, undermine democracy. Some developing countries have experienced this very strongly. When a Wall Street-oriented party loses the election, the markets become unhappy and start pulling their capital out. And because voters know this, they worry about Wall Street's reactions. Wall Street votes as much as the people of the country. The interesting thing is that some markets, like Korea, do not need the money from Wall Street because their people have saved enough on their own. They've linked their market to the global system so that the people in the country with money can move their money to Wall Street and the people from Wall Street can move the money into and out of the country freely. Liberalizing capital markets, making it easier for those on Wall Street to move their money in and out of the country, gives more voting power to Wall Street. Schwartzman saw the consequences. We have become more central to each economy we are in. We realize we have to be responsible players. We would expect not to have people react adversely because what we are doing is trying to develop companies and make them better. And usually we can make that sale almost everywhere in the world. Then he explained another dimension of influence that such firms have. Every once in a while, though, something goes off the rails and you need help from people you don't know personally. That is one of the wonderful things about finance. You can get to anybody in the world with one phone call. We do not try and do these things, he said, but sometimes it is necessary. As private equity, this marching around the globe occasionally hits a speed bump. We hit such a speed bump with a series of accidents in Germany with the locust debate. For those of us who were in business, even private equity, this was shocking. At that point in history, in other countries where we bought companies, it appeared that there was no major opposition to what we did. In Germany, all of a sudden, we were becoming objects of criticism and hostility. And so we looked at that and found that there are a number of studies that have been done in Europe and in Germany in terms of job creation in relation to private equity investments, and I wanted to get the message through. So I asked someone I know to set up a meeting for me with Mrs. Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany. I spent an hour with her and went over the studies and what our objectives were. Mrs. Merkel by training is a physicist, so she is very data-centric and very logical. She listened to all that and said, if you can get your companies to grow much better and hire more people, we should want to do more of that in Germany, not less, because ultimately that is good for us. Our companies will be more competitive because they are facing threats from the East, so I can support you in what you do because it is very logical. And about 8 weeks later, we bought a big stake in Deutsche Telekom from the government and are helping to improve that company. And that's how we have now really gained the chance to turn around the attitude in Germany toward private equity, although others still think negatively about our industry. Schwartzman describes such working of global connections as just the nature of finance. Every country has its large financial institutions that are central to the development of that country, and everyone else in finance knows somebody who will know the head of one of those companies. That person knows a senior person in their government that could be useful in a situation. That does not mean that you will always get your point of view adopted, but all you want is an open hearing to put forward what is on your mind. If people choose not to respond to it, then you cannot do anything about it. But the key is the network. In the end, the world is pretty small. In almost every one of these areas I am looking at, it is 20, 30, 50 people worldwide who ultimately drive the decisions. It amazed me when I was younger. When I was more junior, it was 2 degrees or 3 degrees of separation. As you get older and a little more senior, that number of degrees of separation sort of goes down. It is part of what makes business life so interesting and exciting. You fundamentally can transport yourself with the same alphabet to different geographic places and be able to understand an enormous amount of what is going on because they are using the same language. Speak to private equity executive after private equity executive, and it is clear that this is a business that depends on having the right people in charge. Many of the management teams at the large private equity firms have a revolving door relationship with the most important corporate executive suites or top government offices. While most of the firms are actually run by hardcore Wall Street types, they dress up their executive suites, buy entree, and also buy real management savvy through such associations. For example, in addition to Pete Peterson, who was formerly Secretary of Commerce, Blackstone has former Treasury Secretary and Alcoa CEO Paul O'Neill as a senior advisor. Cerberus's chairman is former Treasury Secretary and CSX Corporation CEO John Snow. Its global chairman is former Vice President Dan Quayle. And according to Fortune magazine, whatever problems Quayle may have had with spelling in a previous life, he has had no problem putting two and two together. Quayle was also on the board of Japan's Nippon Credit Bank and used his connections there to help prepare the way for Cerberus's takeover of that institution. The chairman of the Carlyle Group, famed for its labyrinthine connections to former top government officials, including George H.W. Bush, is now former IBM and American Express CEO Louis Gerstner. From his office in Carlyle's duplex suite in New York City, Gerstner explained, "I cannot argue that a class of global elites does not exist. If you are running a multinational corporation, or are a scientist, or a serious clinician in a research-oriented organization, or are a journalist, you do not think about ideas and opportunities coming with a tariff or through a border. What I'm trying to say is that such elite networks are not about snobbery. They're just there. They evolve. So why not take advantage of it? Why not become part of it? It is so natural today to be a part of a broader community if your purpose is to get better information, sell more products, access more customers." Bill McDonough, vice chairman of Merrill Lynch and former president of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, agreed that a few hundred people are the real movers and shakers in global finance. Each of them does everything possible for the success of his or her firm, but they are fully aware of the need to safeguard the system by not having their elbows too sharp in times of market difficulties. In my experience, both at the Fed and in my various positions in the private sector, the leaders of the world financial community are quite endowed with realism about how much power they have and when and how to use it. Private equity firms, like most financial institutions and big corporations, have the ability to buy high-profile, well-connected individuals who can help expand their networks and influence. So it is in their interest to do so. They also, of course, have another advantage, the ability to buy the best and the brightest when they are still young. One top hedge fund executive said to me, "There are only every year a few hundred people coming out of the best schools in the U.S., maybe a few thousand worldwide, who are the cream of the crop. Where do they start? Once it might have been the Foreign Service or law or some other field, but today we have such a huge advantage in terms of the compensation we can offer that we get first crack. Of course, all that ebbs and flows, too, with market cycles. A couple years ago, we hedge funds were the pinnacle because we were paying starting MBAs base salaries of a couple hundred thousand and bonuses that could double that. Now, private equity firms are offering bases of $300,000, $400,000 and total first-year packages of like $1.2 million. This is to Harvard MBAs or whatever, 25-year-olds. So what would you do if you were that MBA? Where would you work? Trends in the financial community aside, for the past several decades, one of the surest answers to that question has been Goldman Sachs. Since its founding in 1889, Goldman has grown to be the most respected name on Wall Street. The firm's annual revenues are now heading toward the $70 billion level, primarily as a result of its incredibly profitable proprietary trading business and its leadership in investment banking. The firm earned almost $10 billion in 2006. Its office tower at 85 Broad Street in New York City and satellites worldwide house a remarkably privileged group of approximately 30,000 employees. How privileged? The average employee makes $622,000 a year. Next highest paid on Wall Street, Lehman Brothers at $334,000 a year per employee. The top 25 executives in the firm in 2006 were estimated to make $25 million each, with CEO Lloyd Blankfein the top earner on Wall Street, with $54 million. Blankfein's office in Goldman's Tower is on the top floor. Entering through a large, serene lobby, visitors are escorted into a curved suite, the office of the chairman. Blonde paneling, glass, tasteful art, and a bank of assistants constantly in motion create much of the ambiance, but most affecting is the sense that this is truly the center of the business universe. When Henry Paulson was Goldman's chairman before becoming U.S. Treasury Secretary, he created a formidable figure that seemed suited to the setting. Paulson is tall, forceful, and imposing, even in the context of an office at Goldman that featured environmental photographs and books reflecting his deep and abiding passion for birds. Lloyd Blankfein cuts a different image. Smaller, balding, born in the Bronx, he is a master of self-effacing humor, although he is one of the best and brightest types lured to Goldman from Harvard Law School in 1981. He started as a gold salesman at the commodity trading arm of Goldman because he was not considered slick enough to appeal to the investment banking side of the operation. 13 years later, he headed that commodity division, and within 4 more years, he was co-head of Goldman's fixed income, currency, and commodities operations. In 2003, he became president, beating out the very buttoned-down central casting investment banker, John Thain. Cautious and brilliant, Blankfein does enjoy the benefits of his success. During the week, while working around the clock, he lives in a $27 million apartment on the Upper West Side. And for weekends, he almost had a 10.6-acre estate in Southampton on the eastern end of Long Island. The $41 million estate, named Old Trees, features a tennis court, a pool with a view of the ocean, connected to the main house by a heated walkway, and a guest cottage with a pool of its own. But when news of the planned purchase leaked, Blankfein was reportedly furious and canceled the deal, committed as he was to maintaining his low-profile lifestyle. To this day, according to observers in the Hamptons, the low-key Goldman CEO can still slip in and out of the local shops unnoticed, even as sightings of B-list movie stars send waves of gossip through the small downtown. Goldman's influence extends beyond the ability of its analysts and traders to drive stock or bond prices up and down, as they do daily with the reports they write and the decisions they make to buy or sell securities. The firm shapes new views of the world, as it did in 2003, for example, with its suggestion that Brazil, Russia, India, and China were a special class of emerging markets they called BRICS, B-R-I-C's, that would become especially important in the decades ahead. It creates new financial instruments that shape the global marketplace. It can make or break the CEOs and government ministers who regularly pass through its doors looking for capital and for buy recommendations linked to their decisions. And it serves as the hub of an international network of dealmakers. Goldman has a long history of involvement in the public sector. Of Blankfein's four predecessors as CEO, two were Secretary of the Treasury, Hank Paulson and Bob Rubin. Two were the head of the National Economic Council, Rubin and Steve Friedman. And one is the current governor of New Jersey and a former senator, John Corzine. White House Chief of Staff Josh Bolton is a Goldman alum. Former Deputy Treasury Secretary Robert Zoellick served a stint at Goldman before returning to public service as head of the World Bank. And Zoellick's former post at the Treasury Department is now held by former Goldman CEO John Whitehead. During the Clinton years, Treasury Secretary Rubin was joined by former Goldman banker Ken Brody, who ran the U.S. Export-Import Bank. The list extends to scores of senior-level and mid-level officials over the past several administrations who worked at Goldman before and after their government service. It caused business commentator Kyle Pope, writing in the Los Angeles Times, to suggest that no firm has held such economic influence since Standard Oil. Why do rich men undertake low-paying government jobs that are accompanied by press scrutiny and the annoyance of dealing with bureaucracies? It is much the same as it was for Khodorkovsky. There is legitimacy and prestige associated with those jobs, and there is also a chance to go from indirect influence of policies to hands-on management. When I visited the office of a noted Wall Street gray eminence the day after Paulson accepted the job as Treasury Secretary, my host said to me, "There's been a lot of talk about why he did it, and the best explanation I have heard is that he and a lot of the guys he is close to worry about potential market disruptions that could be big problems if the right guy is not in there with his hand on the tiller. I think he feels like he can really add some value, and that he may really be needed." The mortgage crisis later suggested there may have been some merit to this thesis. It is remarkable that there has been a relatively low level of outcry about the steady flow of executives from 85 Broad Street to offices inside the Washington Beltway. Vice Chairman of Goldman Sachs International, Bob Hormats, himself a former senior official, said, "It is fairly unusual. I think it is because it has been demonstrated that when Goldman Sachs people get into these jobs, they give no preference to Goldman Sachs. There is no shred of evidence that they use any of their influence on behalf of Goldman Sachs. If there were, just once, given the remarkable activity of Goldman Sachs in the private sector, it would be over. There would be an incredible hue and cry." Hormats' observation resonates with McDonough's comments about senior financial executives knowing enough not to play too rough with one another. the good of all depends on the successful functioning of the system. Within the system, rules do not have to be broken, although they often are, to do well and exert enormous influence. One of the primary achievements of the leaders of the global financial community over the past several decades has been its ability to globalize markets while promoting the concept of self-regulation or very light supervision. Having senior representatives of that community in the government helps ensure that this remains the case and that any regulatory initiatives that are put forth are crafted with them at the table in influential roles. Especially since these individuals ultimately usually return to the financial sector after their time in government, there are often more than just ideological rewards in store for keeping the system strong. Energy elites, a unique public-private network. Blurring the line between business influence and government influence is exceptionally common regardless of sector. We see the same kind of revolving door in defense contracting, in media, and especially in the energy sector. This is due in large part to the fact that most of the world's largest energy companies are state-owned. More than 3/4 of the world's oil and gas is found in countries whose production is government-controlled, according to estimates by PFC Energy Consultants. It is also due to the fact that energy flows are crucial to the functioning of states, and many oil and gas-rich regions are racked by instability. Thus, military force, primarily in the hands of governments, is key to the functioning of the industry. The government-private sector tug-of-war has affected elites in many nations, especially, as we have seen, major oil-producing countries like Russia. Indeed, the private sector leadership of the energy community has formed one of the most important global power networks, intensely concentrated in the hands of a few key players, and one that, like finance, globalized early on, well ahead of many other industries. Much of this process was driven by the Seven Sisters offspring of Standard Oil. It is also a network in turmoil today, thanks both to geopolitical upheaval and to the recognition that the global energy paradigm is changing as a consequence of global warming, innovations in alternative technologies, and persistent national security concerns about the current system, notably its pricing mechanisms and the unintended consequences of whom it empowers. One set of the principal actors in this hybrid power network are the senior executives of the world's leading nationally owned energy companies, National Oil Companies, NOCs, or the government officials to whom they ultimately report. On the other side are independent oil companies, IOCs, working with them, often possessing more advanced technology and key resources. The two exist in a careful symbiosis, mutually dependent on one another, influencing one another, interacting with one another. Within the realm of the NOCs, Abdallah Jammah, CEO and president of state-owned Saudi Aramco, is arguably the most important executive. He took the position in 1995 following the appointment of Ali I. Al-Naimi, then head of the company, as Saudi Minister of Petroleum and Mineral Resources. Jammah effectively commands the behemoth of the fuel industry. Aramco stands above all other IOCs and NOCs, holding 1/4 of the world's oil reserves in addition to the 4th largest natural gas reserves in the world. Jammah himself has embarked on a mission to both stabilize the price of oil and expand the reach of the corporation into new markets. He undertakes this mission with the ease of a global diplomat, frequenting meetings like Davos and big energy symposia, and although respectful and a good listener, dominating the rooms he is in due to his position. Aramco has made special efforts to form partnerships with non-OPEC members under Jammah's leadership. For years, Aramco has formed the backbone of strong Saudi-American relations and remains a major supplier of oil to Europe. Jammah has sought to diversify Aramco's distribution with a notable focus on the emerging economies in Asia. He recently cited Saudi Arabia and China as one of the most important energy relationships on the planet, and said, "We plan to stand with you, China, for the next century to come." The company has also made considerable efforts to enter into the Indian market, despite a failed attempt to buy Hindustan Petroleum. In 2005, Aramco exported 450,000 barrels of crude oil each day to India and another 500,000 barrels a day to China. These numbers are likely to increase as the Indian and Chinese economies continue to mature and grow in coming decades. Aramco has also made efforts to enter the South Korean energy market and holds a 35% stake in South Korea's third-largest refiner, S-Oil. Due to its importance to Saudi Arabia and the rest of the world, Aramco has inevitably become a lightning rod for criticism. Some religious conservatives have seen the company as too Western and distant from Saudi Arabia itself. Indeed, the company employs 2,000 Americans in Saudi Arabia alone, and English remains its official language. To counteract the criticism, the company has embarked on a mission of Saudiization, and as of 2006, claims that 85% of the workforce is made up of Saudi nationals. The trend toward global integration is not consistent throughout Jumah's management of Saudi Aramco. He has been able to direct and, in some cases, mitigate the forces of globalization so as to maximize profit margins and minimize disruptions. Jumah's predecessor at Aramco, Ali I. Al-Naimi, has been called the Greenspan of oil after former U.S. Federal Reserve Bank Chairman Alan Greenspan. As Saudi Arabia's oil minister, he is one of the industry's most long-standing and influential players. And when Dan Yergin, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Prize and chairman and CEO of Cambridge Energy Research Associates, is asked which individuals comprise the energy cluster of the superclass, Naimi is one of the first names he mentions. Naimi's position atop the Saudi ocean of oil makes him, in the eyes of some observers, the de facto leader of the OPEC cartel, which in turn empowers him to effect change throughout the international energy industry. Naimi's climb to the top of Saudi Aramco and later his appointment as oil minister place him among the technocratic members of the superclass. Educated at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania before studying geology at Stanford, Naimi represents the links between the NOC and the IOC worlds as he attempts to create a supply of fuel that will benefit both the Saudi kingdom and the global economy. This global perspective has helped him iron out numerous problems, from lagging oil prices in the late 1990s to potential oil crises in the face of international instability. He was the man who taught OPEC that ballooning oil prices were not as beneficial as stable prices. Naimi is such an important figure that he has become a weather vane of sorts for the sector. Journalists literally tag along on his morning jogs for a chance revelation about the future of the oil industry. Yergin provided additional insights into this class and how it has evolved. He pointed to the Iranians and an interesting phenomenon in the energy world in which what might otherwise be considered bad behavior produces positive business results. "One thing I've been struck by," he noted, "is how many times over the past couple of years when the Iranians say something about their nuclear program or regional politics that they can drive up the price of their oil and everyone else's. They make a statement or two and the price climbs $5 a barrel and, like that, they've made an extra $85 million that week." According to top Middle Eastern oil executives and industry experts like Yergin, another one of the industry's most important players is Fu Chengyu, chairman and CEO of China National Offshore Oil Corporation, CNOOC. Fu was little known outside of China until his company's failed $18.5 billion takeover of American oil and gas company Unocal in 2005. This move was another example of the expanding power of the Chinese economy, which will increasingly flex its muscle in the coming decades. In Fu's words, the bid represented the changing nature of corporate China. As a native Chinese, Fu's nationality is one of the few characteristics that sets him apart from traditional energy superclass. Otherwise, he fits the mold. He is highly educated, first at China's Northeast Petroleum Institute and then at the University of Southern California. As the chairman of numerous joint ventures, he was able to form extensive links with established oil companies, including BP, Amoco, Texaco, Chevron, and Phillips, early in his career. He joined CNOOC when it was started by the Chinese government in 1982 and worked his way up to become president in 2000 and CEO and chairman in 2002. Like Naimi in Saudi Arabia, Fu was not assisted by political connections in the Communist Party, but rather succeeded by being a non-smoking, non-drinking workaholic with an international outlook. During his time at the head of CNOOC, he has gained the trust of the party and will likely remain as long as it is appeased. Fu's international experience is evident in his management style and aims. He did not see the bid for Unocal as different from any other transaction. It simply made good business sense. He understands the importance of stock markets and believes that transparency makes shareholders love you. The presence of four internationally respected board members, including former Shell CEO Everett Henkes, gives CNOOC an added air of business independence. Nonetheless, the company is controlled by the state, which founded CNOOC to explore China's offshore oil and gas reserves and retains a majority holding in the company. This is a double-edged sword. It gives Fu a strong base of support in an economy that the state sector still dominates, although it is no longer responsible for the majority of Chinese GDP. But it was the government ties that made U.S. lawmakers wary of CNOOC's takeover of Unocal. Since then, Fu has sought to expand CNOOC's international portfolio with investments in Nigeria and Malaysia, among other countries. These deals bring in both traditional oil and liquefied natural gas to China and will ensure that its economy can continue to grow in the future. From the Sun King to the God Pod. On the more purely private side of the energy industry, if such a thing can be said to exist, given the dependency of energy majors on government concessions, regulation, and protection, there is evidence of the kinds of interlocking relationships I have spoken of repeatedly as linking those at the top of the business and government worlds. Few instances illustrate this as well as the case of John Brown's most glittering, although slightly truncated, career as chief executive of British Petroleum. To begin with, of course, BP's American assets are the offspring of Rockefeller's monolithic enterprise, Standard Oil. And, as in the daisy chain described in Chapter 1, Brown himself was one of those individual connective nodes of the superclass, active in key associations and a member of key corporate boards. Notably, he served on the International Advisory Board of Goldman Sachs, even as then-BP Chairman Peter Sutherland, a man who would later become Brown's nemesis in bitter corporate infighting, was chairman of Goldman Sachs International. The son of a former BP manager, Brown was educated at Cambridge before going to Stanford Business School. He joined BP in 1966 as an apprentice and worked his way up to become the company's chief executive in 1995. In the following years, before his resignation in 2007, the Sun King became the darling of the energy superclass through his adept risk-taking and business savvy, which transformed BP into the second-largest IOC behind ExxonMobil. Brown's multi-billion dollar acquisitions of Amoco, Arco, and Castrol ushered in an epoch of mergers that led to the emergence of supermajors in the energy sector. The reason? It's to do with economies of scale, he told The Guardian in 2005. It's to do with a company like BP getting access to the kinds of things that only a big company like BP can do, such as take risks, big risks, and go to places where we can find the great hydrocarbon provinces. With its massive size, BP is now able to reach into new markets all around the world, forming partnerships in countries that had formerly been off limits to Western IOCs. One such market is China, where BP is now expanding its efforts to supply the booming economy with fuel resources. In recent years, the company has dedicated around $1 billion to this end. China, as one of the most rapidly expanding economies, offers significant opportunities for BP, Brown explained in 2004, particularly its customer-facing businesses. We look forward to expanding this through new projects in the future. One of Brown's unique contributions was to turn BP toward more environmentally friendly, green policies. This initiative was the result of his growing concerns about the effect of fossil fuels on the environment and, consequently, on the world economy. Beginning by reframing the company's mission as taking it beyond petroleum, Brown put in place measures that led to the reduction of BP's emissions to 10% below its 1990 levels without cost. Indeed, the company added around $650 million of shareholder value, because the bulk of the reductions came from the elimination of leaks and waste. Even so, some critics said he did not do enough, with one environmental organization castigating him with an ironic award for Best Impression of an Environmentalist. Nonetheless, through his emphasis and his words, if more so than the company's actions, Brown acknowledged the effect of a globalized economy and set a precedent in the business community by pressing world leaders to recognize the threat of global warming. In addition to his position at BP, Brown has served as a non-executive director of both Intel and Goldman Sachs. Through these boards, Brown had regular contact with the current Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson and Intel founder Andy Grove. As he himself once put it, "I serve on these boards because I believe I can contribute, but also because I can learn from great people." His other commitments included the emeritus chairmanship of the advisory board of the Stanford Graduate School of Business and chairmanship of the International Advisory Board at the School of Economics and Management at Tsinghua University in Beijing. Brown was listed as one of Time magazine's most influential people in 2004. He has also been a regular attendee at the annual Bilderberg Conference. With his innovative leadership and extensive connections, John Brown propelled himself to the top of the energy superclass and transformed the global energy market in the process. Even though he ultimately was forced into early retirement due to a series of management misfires and the threat of a personal legal scandal, his influence as a modernizer is still felt. BP continues to advance his Beyond Petroleum message and strategy, even as it also seeks to tighten the management controls that led to the problems precipitating his departure, and still seeks to adapt to a changing global energy paradigm. As a further sign of his influence, despite the problems he faced in his last days with the company, his replacement, Tony Hayward, was known throughout the company as a close associate and protege of Brown. One of the critiques of Brown's tenure at BP during his last tumultuous days was that he was more focused on managing perception of the firm, especially with government and opinion leaders worldwide, than on actually managing the firm's operations, which led to a series of embarrassing and tragic refinery and pipeline accidents. But cultivating high-level ties is hardly unique to BP. In the United States, the close ties of the energy superclass to the government have been the subject of countless books, movies, media exposés, and public debate. From Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 documentary to Craig Unger's House of Bush, House of Saud, ties between big oil and American political leadership have prompted much study and speculation. The facts suggest that the links are extensive. The Bush family, Vice President Dick Cheney, and former Secretary of State James Baker have been or continue to be directly involved with America's energy leadership, for example. A former Secretary of Commerce ran an energy company. Condoleezza Rice was a director of Chevron for 10 years. Donald Rumsfeld and former Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Christine Todd Whitman held considerable holdings in energy-related companies. In 2004 and 2006, major energy companies gave between $20 and $25 million per election cycle to candidates who supported their agenda, on average about 80% to Republicans and 20% to Democrats. Key agenda items for these lobbyists were domestic policies that would curb or forestall costly environmental regulation and, more notoriously, foreign policies, such as intervention in the Middle East or intense pressure on countries like Venezuela, Bolivia, and Ecuador when they threatened to nationalize U.S. energy company assets, that protected their interests. If it does not produce the direct and sinister collaboration that marks movie depictions like Syriana, it is also indisputable that time and again the United States has chosen policies that satisfy the industry agenda, whether wars or tax breaks, resistance to tougher environmental regulations, or looking the other way when oil producers misbehave. See Chapter 9 for the story of Teodoro Obiang, kleptocrat-in-chief of Equatorial Guinea. Energy industry ties to the U.S. government were particularly controversial during the early years of the Bush administration, in the months prior to 9/11. At that time, Vice President Cheney was given responsibility for a reassessment of U.S. energy policy that resulted in a series of more than 300 meetings between the Vice President and his Energy Task Force, the vast majority of which, according to the Washington Post, were with top energy industry executives. Although most of the meetings have remained secret, reports confirm that they included representatives of ExxonMobil, Duke Energy, Constellation Energy, BP, and more than three dozen top industry groups, as well as major Bush supporter and Enron chairman Ken Lay. I remember the mood at the time. My company helped organize a conference on the future of the American energy industry, and Enron was one of its sponsors. The meeting took place at the Ritz-Carlton in Pentagon City, just days after the 9/11 attacks. Enron was still riding high, ranked number 7 on the Fortune 500 list, and one after another, congressmen, senators, and regulators came by to greet Lay, treating him with the kind of deference usually offered to visiting heads of state. It was clear to all that given the prominence of his company, his leadership as a Bush fundraiser, and his special closeness to Cheney, this Houston resident had become a major Washington power broker. He was busy advancing to responsive ears his proposals for less regulation and more market freedom for his traders, who, within a few months, would be revealed to have abused the freedoms they had, and many they did not have. One regulator in particular, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission Chairman Patrick Wood, surprised several observers by not simply delivering his speech and leaving, as did many top officials, but by devoting himself to the event for almost its entire duration and spending a significant amount of his downtime with Lay. The 800-pound gorilla in the U.S. energy superclass today, with the decline and fall of Lay and his associates, is clearly Rex W. Tillerson, who further illustrates the propensity for coziness between big oil and political elites, as well as the cluster's increasingly global reach. Tillerson took the reins at the world's largest public corporation, ExxonMobil, on January 1, 2006. As the Wall Street Journal eloquently describes him, with a Texas twang, rugged visage, and real-life skills on horseback, Mr. Tillerson personifies Hollywood's image of the swashbuckling American oilman. He is one of the few big oil CEOs who never received an MBA or master's degree, but that has not stopped him from reaching a position of extraordinary power and influence. Any inhabitant of the aptly named God Pod, Exxon's executive suite, is by default a major player in the energy cluster of the superclass. ExxonMobil provides 83,700 jobs in 95 countries around the world. In 2006, the company pumped twice as much oil and gas as Kuwait and hauled in $370 billion in revenue with record profits of $39.5 billion. In the United States, the power of the position has provided Tillerson close relations with the White House and a number of high-ranking Republicans, including the former Speaker of the House, Illinois Representative Dennis Hastert. These ties seem to get results when it comes to influencing the political agenda. Immediately after a private meeting with Tillerson in 2006, for example, Hastert took to the floor of the House and called on Congress to allow drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, a position for which he had not previously taken such a vocal stand. Tillerson's de facto clout with political elites also comes as a result of his company's generous budget for lobbyists. ExxonMobil spent more than $7.5 million on lobbying in 2004, and nearly the same amount in 2005. In comparison, its big oil cousins, BP and Shell, spent just $2.8 and $1.4 million, respectively. Political connections extend abroad as well, especially in Russia, where, according to CNN, Tillerson is well connected to officialdom all the way up to President Vladimir Putin. As Tillerson said in 2006, "We live in a global community. Our economies are interdependent, and since energy is such a post of the economic growth, it's only natural that some of the energy supply demand is going to be interdependent as well." As a result, he planned to spend as much as $20 billion in 2007 on oil exploration and production efforts. Adding to the company's existing refinery operations in 26 countries and oil and gas exploration in 37, Tillerson has launched a number of initiatives in the unforgiving tundra of Siberia, where natural gas fields have already provided windfall profits. There, the company controls the U.S. portion of the Sakhalin projects, a consortium of American, Russian, Japanese, and Indian oil companies worth more than $12 billion. Tillerson has another challenge to confront: public opinion. The company and its iconic former CEO, Lee Raymond, whom Tillerson served directly under for 13 years, presented a brash persona that was often characterized as arrogant. Raymond became the bane of environmentalists in particular with his persistent skepticism about the role of fossil fuels in causing global warming. Tillerson has made clear he shares his predecessor's doubts. As Fortune wrote in 2007 in reference to BP's eco-friendly trademark, "Beyond petroleum? At Exxon, it's all petroleum." Despite his defiant stance, Tillerson has attempted to soften the company's image. He argued that, despite gaps in the scientific evidence, the risk to society posed by greenhouse gas emissions may prove significant enough that action is justified now. The importance of one man's view on this issue, given his seat atop the world's largest company, further underscores the centrality of the opinion-leading role of the superclass. But it is also important to remember that these top industry executives touch the lives of millions in other ways too, like through the price of gasoline at the pump. While industry defenders argue that all such prices are simply a result of the market's supply and demand tug of war, that is only part of the story. Companies make decisions about the profit margins they seek, and those decisions take money directly out of the pocket of consumers, just as price increases associated with supply shortages do. And of course, oil producers make other decisions, such as whether or not to invest in new production, or even to increase output, which also impact supply and prices. Consequently, the men at the top of the energy industry influence billions of lives in the most direct ways possible, making decisions impacting key components of the price of a vital commodity. Global industry, global leadership. Today, companies dominate the superclass, and Americans dominate the leaders of those companies. Of the top 22 companies in the world, half are currently led by Americans, a concentration of power in the hands of representatives of a country that is home to only 5% of the Earth's population. But the situation is rapidly changing. The trend lines clearly suggest that more chief executives and top bankers will come from the rest of the world, as more of the largest companies increasingly come from places other than the transatlantic region. In the late 18th century, the Rothschild family built one of the world's great international business networks the old-fashioned way. They had children. The clan's patriarch, Meyer Amschel Rothschild, fathered 19 offspring, 10 of whom lived to adulthood and launched businesses throughout Europe, from Germany to England to Austria to Italy. Today, of course, mergers and acquisitions and new technologies make giving birth to networks considerably easier. This, in turn, opens new opportunities for business leaders from the emerging world to tap into capital and to grow. The Mittals and the Abramoviches, for example, and people like one of China's richest women, Yan Cheng of Nine Dragons Paper Company. Is this a democratizing force that will empower the previously unempowered? Or will the continuous consolidation of global industries simply result in trading one era's group of elites for the next? Some observers suggest that changes in corporate governance requirements are weakening chief executives and promoting a democratizing trend, while others note that power is concentrating among a few key board members, private equity firms, and hedge fund investors, and suggest that power is shifting from managers back to owners. But the global picture is mixed. After the collapse of communism in Russia, leaders wrested economic and political control out of the hands of one small group, the top leaders of the Communist Party and members of the Politburo, and experimented with passing it on to a much broader group. Today, however, much of the economic power that was ultimately grabbed by a few oligarchs and their allies is being reclaimed by the state. Mills had little hope in the prospects for achieving a perfect balance of power between elites and the masses. It is, of course, the role of government and systems of law to manage that balance. Our attention, therefore, turns next to government elites, national and international, operating at a moment of profound historical change that has called into question many of the most fundamental assumptions about the nature and role of the nation-state.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.